Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites right here in WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Soundbites, our production, is produced here in Baltimore at WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and heard on DeMarville Public Radio, WSTL 90.7 FM. We have a lot going on here today on Soundbites, reminding you on the way of this conversation that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. You can also log on to the Steiner Show website and click on the Maryland State Education Association's banner. It's right there. We start our program off today with Michael J. Wilson, Director of Maryland Hunger Solutions. Welcome back, Michael. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark. It's good to be here on Election Day.
On Election Day, and get out there and vote. Folks, got till 8 o'clock tonight, wherever you listen to us from. Vote, vote, vote. So, let's jump right into this. I mean, we talked a lot about school lunches over the period of time together on the air with
each other.
Yes,
we have. And we talked about food stamps.
And food stamps. And the School Nutrition Association that's been talked about before was an association that pushed better nutrition for our kids and really was pushing very hard in Congress for more money per lunch per student in America to ensure that healthier food was on the table.
That's correct.
Something happened. Why don't you pull that mic down a little bit further so you can
hear
it.
Sure. So part of what's happening now, and this is the fight that's going on in Congress, so it's a good time for us to talk about this on Election Day when here in Maryland people are voting for their nominees for Congress, and we're going to reelect people for Congress. But the Congress is weighed in on this battle about healthy school food, and the Institute of Medicine and the USDA have the new rules which are going to come into place this fall, which is going to mean more whole foods for kids, more fruits, more vegetables. No longer will you be able to count fruit juice as fruit. You actually got to have fruit. And so this is going to mean a healthier diet for all the kids in schools all around the country. The challenge is for some schools who have, for a variety of different reasons, tried to cut back on their labor costs, and it's easier for them to take out a bunch of frozen pizzas and plop them in and pass that out to the kids rather than do the more healthier nutrition that's going to be required. And so they've tried an old congressional trick, which is we're going to delay. We're going to give a waiver to folks who don't want to be able to do this right now so they don't have to comply with these new rules. And these rules have been coming down the pike for a while. This is not the first time people knew about this. But it's going to delay the healthier diets for kids all around the country, and we don't think that's right.
But one of the things that's kind of shocking about all this, I mean, we had Congressman Adderholt of Alabama who is pushing this whole thing in Congress to push back on these rules.
Right.
And, you know, you think about, I can remember when pizza was a vegetable became this debate, and then
ketchup was a vegetable.
Ketchup was a vegetable, it was under Ronald Reagan.
Yep.
But what's happened to the student of the School Nutrition Association? I mean, this is a group of dietitians, of people running our schools, people who buy food for our schools together, who is pushing to have raise it to a dollar per student lunch in America, but it's raised 6 cents instead,
right,
to be able to buy healthier food. But something happened along the way. And let me just throw this out and see what you say. I'll just put it out there. That what I've been reading and some of the studies I've seen from Politico and some other places, the Politico article was saying that what's happened is that the SNA is now funded by more than 60% by all the companies that sell the worst food in America, plus all those who distribute the food to our schools. That's changed their policy.
Right. So I don't want to cast aspersions on the association.
I'm not casting aspersions. I'm just going to lay out what I think could be the truth.
And I'm not sure what the reasons why, but I think that's probably part of it. I think the challenge for us is when kids are going to school this fall, this September, why should they not have healthy food now? Why would we delay until they graduate or until they're adults or until their kids are in? This attempt to try to do a waiver or to try to delay is purely a process, a purely congressional process by which you can essentially say no without saying no. And it's going to have the same food going to kids as it was in the past. And we think it's time to move forward and have healthier diets for kids.
So before I get back to the politics of it, I mean, so What will it mean for the lunches our kids are getting? What will it mean literally?
It'll mean more of the same instead of better. And I don't think there's a parent in this country who doesn't want their kids to have better. And I don't think that most policymakers don't want our kids to have better. But they're willing to sacrifice the now for what they think is the better, which is really going
to
come.
But the danger is, it seems to me, well, the waiver is only good for 1 year.
But when asked about the one-year waiver, members of Congress have said, that's right, just 1 year.
But wait,
For now,
these waivers can become permanent.
They
that's
often
the danger.
That's exactly right. And here's the other part. They didn't actually go after this in the child nutrition reauthorization, where it would be legitimate to have this kind of debate about healthy standards or not. They did it in the appropriations process, where they're going to try to limit the funding. So this is the kind of thing that often gets caught up in the omnibus appropriation, where you have the threat of the government shutdown over these kinds of riders. This is the kind of rider that does not belong in an appropriations bill.
410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. I'm curious. I mean, you are a student. You're on break. Talk about your lunches. I know my daughter, who's going to be a senior in a public school, said that she won't eat those lunches. The most horrendous thing she's ever seen.
Right.
So what are your thoughts? Parents, students, teachers, 410-319-8888, and what this might mean. I mean, the First Lady, Michelle Obama, who's been pushing this issue a lot, was quoted as saying around this debate, why are we even having this conversation? Help me understand why, especially given the fact that the School Nutrition Association worked to pass the original changes in nutrition standards. Some people would argue that if it wasn't for the powerful lobbying of the SNA that changed, I mean, all of its past presidents have come out to say are against the waiver. They
right.
fired the lobbyist who was pushing to make this a stronger law.
Right.
They've done a real turnaround.
So I think the SNA has been the poster child for the folks who are arguing for the waiver, but the power behind it is more than just the SNA. It's all the other companies that want to have the same access to our kids to sell their products as before, and not the folks who are really fighting, arguing about nutrition. If I could, can I switch just for a second?
Switch.
I want to talk about WIC, because there's another place where we've had this similar battle, which is in the WIC program, where we have the quote-unquote discrimination against white potatoes. So we got 8.1 million folks in WIC around the country. And these are pregnant women. These are women who recently had kids. This is their infants. This is their kids. And when the Institute of Medicine looked at the basket of what's required for kids, they did not include white potatoes. They said that's not a necessary nutrient that they have to put in the basket. People are going to have that. People are going to buy that. But that shouldn't be in what's reimbursable by WIC. And the folks in Congress, particularly who represent states that sell white potatoes or make white potatoes, think Idaho, think Maine, were up in arms because they wanted it included. Interestingly enough, in Maryland, in the WIC program, they've done a study about consumption of white potatoes, and WIC participants have white potatoes on a regular basis. And guess how they have them? French fries. French fries are regularly consumed by people in WIC, and
right.
that's because they use other
it's
funds.
It's not really funny. I mean, I'm laughing because of the absurdity of it.
It's the absurdity of
so
it.
So the unhealthy, you can eat a potato that can be really healthy and delicious, or you can eat French fries.
Right. So you can, if we take white potatoes.
That. I do like French fries, but I mean.
Right, right. But if you take white potatoes out of the basket, people are not going to not consume white potatoes. They're still going to have them, both as French fries and in other ways. But to focus, as the Institute of Medicine has done, on what's actually nutritious for kids, for infants, for pregnant mothers, and to change that, as Congress is trying to do, Congress wants to change this. They want to overturn this. And this would set a precedent for political coverage, for political change here, as opposed to focused on the health of infants and mothers.
So literally what is being done to address this problem? Where is the resistance to this change coming from? What are the voices out there?
So the voices are groups like ours. It's from pediatricians. It's from doctors. It's from health officials. No one who really focuses on the health of pregnant mothers and kids thinks this change should be needed. But if you're for potatoes, and if you're for other products that might get in after potatoes get in, you want to help push this change through. And so that's the political dynamic we see in the Congress, that they're once again willing to overturn science and overturn medicine on behalf of folks who want to sell to our kids. That 8.1 million folks, 144,000 in Maryland, is a market that they don't want to have taken away from them.
Well, that's clear. I'm curious what you think, what the response has been from, what do you know about the response from Maryland's congressional delegation?
Maryland's congressional delegation has been mostly pretty good on this. But the challenge is, in the Senate, where Senator Mikulski is chair of the Appropriations Committee, she's been supportive. In the House, where the House Republicans run the House in a very authoritarian manner, it doesn't, even that, given the split in Maryland's delegation, they're not going to have an opportunity to actually have a vote on this because the committee has decided, and that's the committee bill, and it looks like we're not going to get a clean up-and-down vote on white potatoes in the House.
What about the entire issue around school lunch? Where's our delegation on this?
So our delegation is pretty good. The problem is, once again, the House is going to pass a bill, even if all the Democrats vote against it, the House is going to pass a bill that includes all of these provisions, but also, given the dysfunction of the Congress, it looks like we're not going to get an ag appropriations bill. It looks like we're going to have some kind of an omnibus appropriations bill, and we're going to have the threat of whether the House and Senate agree and whether they can't agree, and if the president weighs in, and whether we're looking at a veto threat or whether we have a partial government shutdown over fights about these kinds of policy riders in the appropriations bill.
So what talk about before we have to go. I'm very curious about the work you all are doing around the summer hunger gap that goes on between the school sessions.
Right. So, you know, one of the things that's been documented is the education gap. When kids stop going to school,
right,
and they're not reading, they're not writing, they're playing, they're doing all the other things. And so kids have been encouraged to do some kinds of academic efforts over the summer so they don't lose that academic edge. There's also a nutritional gap. Kids who get school breakfast, who get school lunch, who get after school meals, when the school ends and they don't have that, there's a nutrition gap that they face. And so we've been instrumental, along with other groups in the state of Maryland, the governor's partnership to eliminate childhood hunger, to push forward for summer feeding programs. And so there are sites all around Baltimore, all around the state of Maryland, where kids can go and have a healthy lunch, and it's reimbursed by USDA. And our goal is to make sure that we don't have that hunger gap, if at all possible.
So I really appreciate the work of Maryland Hunger Solutions, the stuff you're doing. So, is there anything citizens can do to address the issues we've been talking about here today?
Well, the first thing they can do is, today's election day. You got to go out and vote. You got to educate yourself. But if you don't vote today, you know, you don't get a chance to vote again until November. And your votes are members of Congress vote on your issues hundreds of times during the course of the year. You only get two chances every 2 years. You got to go out and vote. The second thing is, you got to educate yourself about these issues. You can go to our website, mdhungersolutions.org. There are other organizations that do a lot of good work. You should look at them. But then you can also participate. We look for volunteers all the time to help us help fight hunger in the state of Maryland, and eliminating hunger in Maryland is our main mission.
Michael J. Wilson, a regular here on the Steiner Show and Soundbites, director of Maryland Hunger Solutions. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for being with me, having me here.
Always good to see you.
Thanks.
We're going to take a brief break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Joanna Diamond, Mitch Jones, and Jeremy Cox to look at the issues around the environment, food, agriculture, the air we breathe, the water around us in this election. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back here to the Mark Steiner Show and to Soundbites as we have our weekly look at agriculture, food, and our environment here on the Mark Steiner Show. I want to encourage all of you, by the way, to get out and vote today. The primary election is taking place right now, so wherever you are, please vote today. You can check at elections.state.md.us to hear where you go, to see where you can go vote, where your polling place is. You can go to steinershow.org and click on all the candidate interviews. You want to refresh your minds a bit about what they were saying and how we've been covering the races here. But whatever you do, go out and vote. You heard the piece at the top of the hour I did about Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman, where they died in this country to fight to end terrorism, but also for the right to vote. So vote. Don't forget to vote. Speaking of voting, we're talking about what we're voting for in this election and how the environment is affected by it, by our food system, our cultural system. What are the issues here? Not necessarily endorsing anybody, but talking about some of the candidates, but also talking about the larger issues. We're joined by Joanna Diamond, who is Director of Environment Maryland. Joanna, welcome to the studio.
Great to be here. Thanks, Mark.
Mitch Jones is back with us, Director of Common Resources Program at Food and Water Watch. Good to see you, Mitch.
Good to see you, Mark.
And Jeremy Cox joins us by Skype. He's reporter at the Daily Times of Salisbury. Jeremy, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good morning.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. And just for our Baltimore listeners here, let me say that we've had some people call in, not sure where the vote in the 43rd district. Do I have that right? Yeah. So it is the Waverly Elementary School is the replacement polling place for people who normally vote at the Waverly Library, which is being renovated. So you have to go to the Waverly Elementary School to place your vote. So go do there. We'll tell you that again before the end of the hour. So good to have all three of you with us. So let's talk a bit. We've talked a lot. I mean, I've interviewed all these candidates and pushed them all on these various different environmental issues that we're facing in the state of Maryland. The question is, where are we, do we think? Jeremy Cox, let me start with you. I mean, give us your report card on where we are.
Well, environmentally speaking, we just signed a new Bay Agreement with the other states involved with the Chesapeake Bay restoration effort. And, you know, the overall take-home seems to be kind of a mixed bag, where for the first time we have West Virginia and New York entering, which is a very important piece to the puzzle because, of course, their water flows into the Chesapeake. And for the first time, it includes some broad goals for toxic chemicals and for climate change. But on the other hand, you don't see it's a voluntary agreement. So you can opt out at any time on any of the particular parts of it. So there's pluses and minuses. And I think that is sort of indicative of the larger environmental picture here in Maryland, where you know, you're certainly seeing a number of steps forward under the O'Malley administration, but maybe not as far as some of the advocates would like to see it go.
So and let me turn to our guest here in the studio first. Joanna, I'm curious your thoughts on what the issues are. What are the issues as you see them that are critical to the election taking place today here in the state of Maryland?
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, we have a pretty set date of 2017, and that's the date by which Maryland has to take all of the necessary steps to achieve the 60% pollution reduction goals that are set by the total maximum daily load from the Clean Water Act. And we're not there yet, and we're not even necessarily on the road to getting there. I think there have been some really great efforts to get there. As was mentioned, I mean, the Bay Agreement was an opportunity, but it's certainly not where it needs to be. And I think that there are a lot of opportunities that we can see sort of moving forward with a roadmap to how to get there. I think one of the really wonderful opportunities that we see is actually starting to implement the regulations around the phosphorus management tool, which is one of the best opportunities that we have to actually reduce the phosphorus pollution loads actually as part of the agricultural operations on the Eastern Shore and other places. So while we've seen delays in that, which is a result of many things, but one of them being the delays that were put put forth by the administration. I think that's a really wonderful opportunity to actually make real change, and we just simply need to get there, and we need to all do our part to be supportive of actually taking those proactive steps in actually reducing pollution.
There are very few people I've interviewed in the course of this campaign, that Ms. Jones, that would come out directly and say, yes, it was a mistake to delay the phosphorus management tool, and yes, I will make sure it's implemented when I'm elected. A couple have, but not very many.
Right, which is a problem. It's a problem. Mm-hmm. It was delayed in the first place. It never should have been. That was pure politics on the part of the O'Malley administration deciding to delay the implementation of the PMT after they had made an agreement to do it. I mean, it was just a complete and utter turnaround because they received a little bit of pushback from the agricultural community that for some reason they either didn't anticipate or were planning to do all along. So it's a real problem. You know, to be honest, I have to say that as a resident of Baltimore and as a Marylander, I've been a little disappointed that the environmental issues, the big environmental issues, haven't been front and center in the election. We haven't really heard a lot about what the candidates are going to do to reduce agricultural pollution, agricultural runoff, whether it's actually implementing the PMT, whether it's my favorite solution, the Poultry Fair Share Act.
Which we'll talk about in a moment.
Which we will talk about. I know we will. but even beyond, you know, the ag issues, when you get into the issue of something that's not food and ag directly related but does, of course, affect it, fracking, climate change, a lot of those issues just haven't had the high level of debate that we would have hoped to have seen in this election year. You know, there's a real opportunity here. We've got competitive races for governor, for attorney general. We've got a lot of competition for state Senate and House seats. There's going to be a huge turnover. And it's really disappointing that, you know, people come here and they talk about it because you make them talk about it. But unfortunately, the broader media hasn't really forced the candidates to distinguish themselves on these important issues.
So, I mean, when you talk about people, it's not front and center. I think part of the reason it's not front and center, we can talk about this just for a moment before we get back to more specific issues, is because when you look at people worrying about taxes, look, people worrying about the debt, people worrying about the reform of our prison system and what's happening to so many young people of color in our state being put to prison and confronted by the prison system, the poverty growing in our poorest communities. So it's hard sometimes for people when they just see water that doesn't look so bad. You know, why am I rushing into this? Why is this priority? I think that's part of the problem.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, that's something that we at Food and Water Watch, and I'm sure Joanna at Environment Maryland, you know, deal with every day, is you can put these issues out of mind because they don't necessarily show themselves to you. You know, we do a lot of work on trying to get infrastructure funding for sewer systems, which a lot of people forget is actually an environmental and public health issue, right? Having a functioning sewer system. And here in Baltimore, you can drive and see water bubbling up through the streets all over the place. But nobody really notices it until the water main break is in front of your house or until the sewer backs up into your basement. So we're used to the idea that these issues are kind of not at the front of people's minds because they have, you know, is my kid going to be able to get into a good school? Am I
right.
going to be able to, you know, the interview you just did with Michael J. Wilson, am I going to be able to have a healthy lunch for my kid? Those issues, you know, take precedence. But at the same point in time, is my kid, when he goes outside to play in the summer, going to be able to breathe healthy air? Is the food system that's producing the food for him likely to provide healthy food? Those issues are, you know, I would argue as equally important, but hidden.
So, yeah, as my producer just chatted over here, he said, yep, at the bottom of my street in Edner and Alameda, it's been a geyser for days now.
Yeah. Yeah.
So those things are very real. The infrastructure
right.
blows up. Jeremy, you want to comment on that before we go to break, and then we'll go to Joanna?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we were talking about the Poultry Fair Share Act. As I guess since I'm sitting here on the Eastern Shore, I should say, you know, over here it's obviously seen as the death knell of the poultry industry, adding a 5-cent tax to each head of poultry here. And, of course, it didn't pass this last session, but it's fair to say we'll be watching that very carefully this next legislative session next year. It certainly is seen as, like, the next to the phosphorus management tool anyway, the biggest enemy of the shore right now.
That, and we'll get into that right at the break. And we'll take us to break here very quickly, Joanna. Your thoughts about why you think this is not front and center in people's minds? What to do about that?
Well, you're right. It certainly is not, and it hasn't been in the gubernatorial debate really at all front and center or in any meaningful way in these debates, which also myself as a Baltimore resident has been, something that I've been concerned about. But, you know, the reality is that our food system production has become increasingly concentrated in the hands of just a few corporations, and it in turn reshapes the way our food is produced, the types of food that we get, the unhealthiness of the food, and also has, oftentimes been detrimental to our environment. So the reality is that, in terms of what we're going to do about this, one of the most common sense things we can say is that we want to hold corporate agribusinesses who actually produce our food, which has truly sort of taken over and really been concentrated in their power, responsible for the pollution that it produces. It's a simple concept. The Poultry Fair Share Act helps get us there, and it's certainly something that is going to shape the way our food is produced and the food that we actually consume here.
Okay, well, we're going to take a break. Let's come back and we'll tackle both the Poultry Fair Share Act and the PMT about what role they play in this election, what role they may play in after election, where we are with them, the Eastern Shore perspective, the Western Shore perspective, the Maryland perspective. Stay with us. We'll be right back. 410-319-8888, The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community out of Baltimore, Maryland, across the state of Maryland. And you're also hearing us on DeMarvo Public Radio at WSTL 90.7 FM. We are joined here by Joanna Diamond, Director of Environment Maryland, Mitch Jones, Director of the Common Resources Program at Food and Water Watch, and Jeremy Cox joining us from Salisbury, where he's a reporter at the Times of Daily Times of Salisbury. 410-319-8888 is our number here. Join us here at also by logging onto the Facebook or emailing me at steinershow@gmail.com or tweeting me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Let's get into this whole question of Poultry Fair Share Act. I mean, I said to you all during the break that I pushed this with every candidate I've talked to just to see what their opinion is and where they stand on it and on the PMT. And very few have said, yes, I'm for the Poultry Fair Share Act. Most said, no, I'm not. I mean, Heather Mazier said, yes, she was for it. Here in some local senatorial race, Bill Henry said, I'm opposed to fracking and I am for the Poultry Fair Share Act. And Senator Conway said no. And so we had these debates and discussions on the air. So it is an issue that's bubbling under. It's not raised that much. But clearly it's gathering some steam. And I'm curious, you talked about the perspective in Delmarva on the shore, Jeremy, about this whole question of Poultry Fair Share Act. And talk a bit about what you're hearing in terms of where that is going, both politically and what the discussions are on the shore.
Sure. So if you talk to the industry over here, they say, well, the advocates for this particular for the Fair Share Act, really both the PMT as well, they say you're not realizing all that we're already doing in terms of the millions of dollars being planted, in cover crops and creating buffer zones. And they'll often point to the fact that nitrogen pollution is decreasing. And I think you'll be hard pressed to find a farmer of any kind here who will say a kind word about either one of those regulations. It should be noted, though, that it's the soil here is like a sponge. It's an already saturated sponge of phosphorus, and we keep pouring more water on it in the form of the chicken litter. So, we know that here. We know that to be true. And yet, if we were to turn off that faucet, we would essentially being upending the entire agricultural economy here on the shore. What would we do with that litter? So it is highly unpopular would be an understatement.
It would be an understatement. I mean, I've covered it on the shore as well. That's why I think that it's important to kind of wrestle with what this means and what the where the battles will be and whether this is going to be very serious legislation or just by advocates and not much else. Joanna?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Poultry Fair Share Act embodies a lot of really good concepts, right? As a resident of Baltimore, you know, I pay fees to help restore the bay. I mean, I'm proud of being able to pay those taxes and those fees, and I'm proud to be able to help my environment. But ultimately, one of the number one polluters of the bay is the agricultural sector, and they are not paying what I pay at all. To actually restore the bay. So I think that we, in terms of fairness and in terms of equitability, we really need to level the playing field for all Marylanders. And I think that something like the Poultry Fair Share Act in actually putting the burden on the actual polluter polluting into the bay is something that is fair and equitable for all Marylanders. And I think they're concepts that we can all get behind.
Yeah, I think, you know, the idea that the ag industry is, and here let's, by that we mean the poultry industry, is planting the cover crops is a little bit off key, because what's really happening is, you know, here in the city we pay a flush tax. It goes into municipal. If you have into municipal utilities, if you have a septic system, you also pay. It's not a flush tax, but you pay the same $60 a year fee. But half of that is diverted to pay for these cover crops. So it's not the industry paying for cover crops. Let's get that straight. It's rural septic system users who are paying for these cover crops. What the Poultry Fair Share Act does is it puts a fee on the poultry industry and then puts that money into the cover crop program. It's not taking money away from the cover crop program. It's putting additional monies into it. In terms of whether or not it's a serious piece of legislation, I think if you just take a look at the political reaction to it, you know, I mean, the governor with his over-the-top veto threat before the bill, you know, had even had a chance to have a hearing, shows you that this is a real – this is a political reality. If you were at the hearing, you heard folks on both sides say, hey, this thing's not going to make it this year, but it might have legs in the future. And, you know, the sponsors of the bill have been busy. It is election day again, after all. And Rich Maddaleno, the Senate sponsor, and Shane Robinson, the House sponsor, have been running the reelection campaigns. But we anticipate if they're both renominated, that we're going to sit down with them and talk about what the bill is going to look like. It will be reintroduced. Hopefully, they will both be reintroducing it. I talked to Shane just the other day, and he's indicated he's willing to, and Senator Maddaleno has given no indication he's not. But the bill might be tweaked a little. There were some good suggestions made as to how to make it stronger. But the fact of the matter is, you know, there's been two recent reports that came out that show that tributaries to the Chesapeake Bay on the eastern shore are still woefully bad in terms of their environmental health, and that the main reason for this, both of these studies said, was chicken litter and farm runoff from the chicken litter. So we need to do something about that. The PMT is one way to do it, but that, oddly enough, puts the cost on
phosphorus management tool.
Sorry, yeah, phosphorus management tool. That, oddly enough, as a political scientist, I believe, at Salisbury pointed out, would make the farmers pay for cleaning up the phosphorus. And the governor supports that. The administration supports that. The legislature supports that. But the Poultry Fair Share Act would actually make Purdue pay. It would make the integrator, the poultry company, pay. And there's great opposition to making them pay, but lots of support for actually making the growers pay. And that is a distinction that I think people need to keep in mind about the politics in this.
So, Jeremy, I have two questions for you around that. The first is, I mean, the nuance that Mitch describes here with the Poultry Fair Share Act, is that part of a discussion you're hearing as you do your reporting and your conversations on the shore?
That's an interesting point he makes there that about that. And I think with the Poultry Fair Share Act, because it's got the word tax in it, it's been easier to make, obviously that resonates poorly here in the conservative shore. So I think that's been an easier argument to make there that, we are against this and, if we have to add 5 cents on top of our cost of poultry, on top of whatever costs there are with the phosphorus management tool, the Maryland's largest industry, agriculture, won't be able to compete with, its brethren in other states, and you could pretty much kiss goodbye our industry. So maybe it's a matter of semantics there that's helping that case.
Can I just interject real quickly to say that ag is not the largest industry in Maryland by a long shot. In fact, if you go to the state of Maryland's own website that lists the size of industries, ag comes in just above mining. It's second to last. It's 0.2% of GDP. It's actually not the largest industry in Maryland. Reporters, I've heard it here on your show before, Mark, and you know, we've had conversations about it. I've heard United States senators say it. It's just not true. It is not the largest industry in Maryland. It is a major industry on the Eastern Shore. It's a major industry in many counties, but it is not anywhere near the largest industry in Maryland.
I mean, this is a discussion I'd like to have on the air and just really kind of parse that out and see what the reality is. And that changing the poultry industry on the Eastern Shore would affect the economy of Maryland and the economy of the Eastern Shore. I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, I think that it just deserves a separate discussion to really get to the bottom of this question of just where the poultry industry lives and the power, I mean, the place it plays in our economy. But, John, do you want to comment on this before I move to another subject?
Well, I think the economic viability of the state also depends on the equity and fairness that is throughout the state. And, you know, the reality is that Purdue and these other big poultry firms and poultry corporations gain the benefits of control over the production process while disclaiming the responsibility for the pollution their animals produce when other Marylanders, normal Maryland residents and citizens, are fronting the fees to help clean up the pollution that they produce. So we're really left in an untenable situation. It's untenable for Maryland and it's untenable for our economy.
So one of the things that the Republican candidates have said on the show, almost to a person, as we talk about their races for governor, is that their response to what's going on in the Bay is the dredging of the dam around Conowingo because of all the silt that comes in from Pennsylvania and north, mm-hmm. and that is a real issue. I mean, it's backed up. You saw what happened when the flooding happened. But that's the response they give in our discussions around what should be the priority. It should be the dammed up silt that comes where they say the majority of the nitrogen comes from that comes into the Bay. So I'm curious what we think about that, how that fits into this political debate discussion and what that means for the environment. Jeremy, I mean, I'm curious how you've covered that.
The chance to go up to Senator Cardin's field hearing a couple of months ago about that. And, you know, we didn't hear a lot about that here on the shore, about the Susquehanna, until the, you know, the increased pressure started coming down from regulators. And talk about the phosphorus management tool and the tier maps and all these other things. So, yeah, the one hand, you know, if you wanted to look from the outside, you would say, well, that sounds like a red herring to me, you know, we don't want to have to do our own share, so we should point to, you know, another polluter. But on the other hand, I think everyone agrees that the Susquehanna is, you know, certainly a major contributor to the Bay's sediment problem and to its nutrient problem. So, you know, down here, I think it's obviously, you know, Wicomico just joined. Dorchester was the one that led the fight to, you know, create this coalition, the Clean Chesapeake Coalition, to draw attention to it. I'm actually more interested to hear what the Western Shore has to say about that, because, you know, over here we just you can't have a discussion with county leaders or with farmers about the Bay without, you know, the conversation being steered in that direction.
I think that's true.
Yeah, that's certainly been my experience in Annapolis in particular. That whenever you start talking about Bay pollution, one of the Republicans on the Environmental Matters Committee is going to say Conowingo. In fact, there's kind of a pseudo drinking game that's built up around it. We don't actually drink because we're sitting in the hearing room, but it's a matter of time. So, look, I do think obviously the Susquehanna contributes to the pollution of the Bay. It just does. But I do think it is a bit of a red herring in that every single time you talk about trying to clean up agricultural pollution from the Eastern Shore, and Eastern Shore legislator will say Conowingo, because they're trying to deflect the blame instead of trying to actually clean up their act. And, you know, when Joanna mentioned equity and fairness earlier about who's paying for this stuff, let's be clear that, you know, it's not the growers that are going to be benefiting from well, in a sense, the growers are going to be benefiting from this because they're stuck with the chicken litter, right? Purdue pretends that the chicken litter is a great, wonderful, valuable gift that they leave for the contract growers, the folks who are actually raising the chickens for them. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, we in Maryland, between 2008 and 2012, paid Purdue $2.5 million for them to come to those farms, pick up that chicken litter, and transport it to their own pelletizing agro-recycle business to turn it into fertilizer. You know, so this idea that somehow the growers are being hurt by what we're doing, the fact of the matter is the growers, the farmers, the people who raise the chickens are hurt by their relationship with the big poultry integrators.
So you were about to say what, Joanna?
I just wanted to piggyback off a piece when you're talking about the subsidies that are to Purdue and these other corporations. I mean, one of the things that I think that we can all get behind as Maryland citizens is the fact that an environmentally and economically healthy Maryland means an open and transparent government. And a lot of these corporations, as Mitch pointed out, do receive some substantial subsidies on the backs of Maryland taxpayers. And Maryland taxpayers, unfortunately, do not have the benefit of actually being able to see the data and the pollution and how those subsidies are actually utilized, even though they are paying for it, is their right. And so we need to reform also the government transparency system in the state.
So a quick question here. I'm curious. You know, we're talking about that there may be 50 new legislators coming into okay. this body, at the very least this election, not counting ones who may be defeated who are incumbents. Let me go very quickly to start with Joanna, and I'm going to go over to Jeremy. What you think that will mean?
I mean, I think that there's a really incredible opportunity here. I think that in terms of what we can do as citizen advocates is actually educate these new legislators coming in. I think through the PMT, through Poultry Fair Share Act, through a lot of these government transparency policies that are coming down the pike, we have really an incredible opportunity to educate all of these folks and really you know, have them sort of get behind sort of a roadmap to how to actually clean up the bay. Like I said, there is a really hard deadline of 2017, where we actually need to meet legal mandates. And so we have a roadmap to get there, and I'm really excited to be able to educate the new candidates.
And Jeremy, how do you see that? We only have like a minute or so left here in this segment, so I want to get your both closing thoughts, Jeremy Cox, and then we'll go over to Mitch Jones.
Sure. I mean, obviously, any election is a time for people to go out and, you know, affect change. And this is an exciting time to be in Maryland. I just don't see the political parties being changed all that much. I mean, here on the shore, we'll continue to elect Republicans. PG and Montgomery will continue to elect Democrats. And we will continue to have to come to compromises between those two geographic areas for things like the phosphorus management tool and the poultry tax.
Very quick thought, Mitch.
Yeah, it's going to be an exciting new session in 2015. You know, there's going to be a lot of opportunity with all those new members. And I think we just have to work to make sure that they know the issues so that what doesn't end up happening is that more power gets consolidated in the hands of leadership and in the folks who issue the orders down in Annapolis, because, you know, we need to affect some real change here, and this is a great opportunity.
Mitch Jones is director of the Common Resources Program at Food and Water Watch. Jeremy Cox, reporter at the Daily Times of Salisbury. Joanna Diamond, director of Environment Maryland. Thank the three of you so much for this this conversation about today's election and what the environmental issues. Looking forward to having you all back again.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks so much for having me.
Don't wave, folks. We're coming right back with Mike Tidwell. We're going to find out what is happening with Cove Point and this liquid natural gas facility. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show and to Soundbites here on WEAA 80.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we're also heard on the Marvel Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM. Remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. Belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information, www.mecu.com, or you can log on to steinershow.org and click on their banner, MeQ, Baltimore's Credit Union. We are now joined by Mike Tidwell, who joins us here on Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites once again. Mike Tidwell is the founder and director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network and author of The Ravaging Tide, The Strange Weather, Future Katrinas, and The Race to Save America's Coastal Cities. Mike, welcome back.
Thank you, Mark. It's great to be back.
Always good to have you with us. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. So, Mike, this is an update we're doing today on what's going on with Cove Point, the liquid natural gas facility. But what I'd like you to start with, if you would, and you can describe what FERC is. I mean, I think everybody was kind of, even those who support the liquid natural gas facility being built at Cove Point, were kind of really taken aback by the, but describe what FERC is, but taken aback by their decision.
Well, FERC stands for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. They basically regulate and provide final permits for major electricity infrastructure and gas projects in this country. And so the proposed Cove Point facility to liquefy just, you know, 750 million cubic feet of gas from the Marcellus Shale region, mostly Pennsylvania, potentially Maryland, frack gas. They want to liquefy that at Cove Point on the Chesapeake Bay in southern Maryland and ship it to India and Japan. FERC gets the final say on that. The Maryland Public Service Commission has weighed in and provided conditional approval, but FERC gets the final say. And what has really upset and shocked environmentalists and health officials in the state is that FERC refuses to do a number of things. They refuse to do a full environmental impact statement for this $3.8 billion facility, and they also refused even to give the Maryland public 30 additional days to comment on their limited environmental study that came out on May 15th. So both Senators Cardin and Mikulski asked for more public comment or public comment period. The EPA asked for a longer public comment period. And FERC said, no, you get 30 days, not 60 days, not 90 days. So this is just emblematic, we believe, of isolated, secretive, non-responsive commission whose job, instead of regulating the gas industry, in our view, their job is to facilitate it. They're not interested in public health and the environmental impacts nearly as much as they are in just facilitating the expansion of this fracked natural gas export industry.
So a couple of things. I mean, also was kind of a slap in the face is I think you wrote to Congressman Steny Hoyer, who supports the facility, and fracking. I mean, he is in support of it, and he was calling for a 30-day extension as well.
Yes, this facility would be built in southern Maryland in Congressman Steny Hoyer's district, and even Steny Hoyer asked for more time to look at these this environment, this limited environmental assessment that FERC did, and FERC said no to the congressmen and the senators. You know, it's clear that FERC wants to go forward with this as soon as possible. And as a result, there will be the inevitable lawsuits that are going to be filed shortly that challenge the entire way that FERC has conducted this permit process, including FERC's failure to calculate the greenhouse gas emissions that would come or that would be triggered by Cove Point. Interestingly, 3 weeks ago, the U.S. Department of Energy, you know, a separate federal agency, calculated that if you take all the life cycle greenhouse gases that come from exporting liquid natural gas to Asia, and that's where this Cove Point gas is going to, it's going to Asia. If you take the life cycle leakage of the methane gas at the fracking well and the pipelines and the compressor stations, and then all the energy it takes to put these this liquid gas on tanker ships to Asia and then regasify it and use it in Asia, that the life cycle greenhouse gas emissions probably make this gas worse than if Asian nations burn their own coal in terms of climate change. So it looks like we're rushing to export something that's worse than coal, and yet FERC won't even calculate the environmental harm.
So let me just say this before we let people know that we also did contact Dominion Cove Point LNG to join us for this conversation today about what's happening with the facility we've been covering at Cove Point. And the response was to our producer, Mark. Jim is out this week. Thanks for the invitation. But we will pass on this, signed by Carl Nedenine, who is Media Relations and Community Relations Manager for Dominion Cove Point LNG, declining our request. I just wanted to let you all know that is that we did invite everybody here for that conversation. So I just wanted to be clear about that. So the question is, you know, you were in the discussion we had here the other week, Mike, about the environment, the future of energy on some levels, and workers' rights and workers' jobs. So let's speak about that for a moment. I mean, one of the reasons that so many unions and others support LNG is because that plus the gas industry talks jobs, and jobs that pay a decent wage. And that's an issue for a lot of people, who, especially in this down economy.
Well, as Joe Uline, former steelworker who was on that same program with us, Mark, a couple of weeks ago, said, Joe Uline said, we need to stop thinking of all jobs as good jobs. There are some jobs that are not good jobs, and nobody wants a job being the grave digger of the planet. And unfortunately, fracking and exporting this gas to Asia is such an enormous contributor to climate change. And climate change is already causing extensive flooding along Maryland's 3,000 miles of tidal shoreline. I mean, we're a water state, and we're experiencing the pain of sea level rise already. And it's going to get a lot worse unless we do what? Unless we keep the fossil fuels in the ground. We need to stop bringing them up and lighting them on fire and instead moving toward greater efficiency, wind and solar, which wind and solar and efficiency create more jobs per dollar spent than fracking and coal and tar sands oil. So that's, I think, the main point is that, you know, I come from a union household. I support jobs. There are so many jobs that have already resulted from Maryland's clean energy laws. There are wind farms that have been built with union labor. There's solar farms that are being installed right now that with union labor. There's a wind turbine manufacturing company called Ventower that is planning to move to Baltimore and create a lot of jobs. So we have better alternatives than fracking gas and shipping it to Asia at a carbon intensity greater than coal.
Well, Mike Tidwell, I think we'll pick up on that point. We'll go back to Cove Point in the next few weeks and bring you back in here to talk about where we are, where the movie is struggling to stop it, but also where the future is in terms of jobs. I want to thank you once again, Mike Tidwell, founder and director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, for joining us here.
Mark, let me just say, July 13th, there will be a big rally in Washington. Your listeners can go to stopgasexports.org. stopgasexports.org, and there will be a big rally on Cove Point in Washington, D.C., July 13th. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you so much, Mike. We'll have that on our website as well and be covering that. Thank you all for joining and listening to us today. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our engineer at DeMarvel Public Radio is Chris Rank. Our interns are Alex Boston and Sienna Greaves. To hear this show again, podcast all of our past shows, find out information about our guests and the work they do and what they talk about on the air, go to steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download all of our podcasts on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.